back to the Veteran Next Door live. Call 865-243-8255. That's 243-TALK. And now your host, Randall Baxter.
Welcome back to the Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we're talking about bridges in the Knoxville area named after veterans. You know, and a couple other things that I want to make you aware of, though. Something you just might want to know. You know, if you are one of these veterans, or you have a family member who's a veteran, if you're having, well, just think about this. Let's think about this elderly veteran that might be your father or your mother or spouse of a veteran or a grandparent, Vietnam veteran, Korean veteran, World War II veteran. You know, are they having trouble taking a bath safely or getting dressed? Or is their grooming getting a little tough to bear with? Do you know if they're actually brushing their teeth or toileting properly? Or can they get out of a chair and into a bed? How about walking? Do you worry about them walking and falling? Or climbing stairs and maybe falling down the stairs? Are they eating properly? Who does their shopping? Who does their cooking? And a big one, who manages their medications? Who's calling them on the phone? Who's selling them things? Who does the housework? Who does the laundry? Is the laundry even being done? Who drives them to the doctor? Who manages their finances? You know, and a lot of people may be independent, but they might need a little help. Or they might be totally dependent. Or they might not even have those things done. You know, so folks, you know, we talk about a lot of folks that have PTSD and traumatic brain injury or loss of a leg or a foot or an arm in battle. And we know those folks, they have service-related disabilities. But there's also a non-service-related disability benefit for veterans who fought during wartime in the United States. You know, and most people don't even know that the benefit is available to them, or they don't think they qualify, or they have been told that they don't qualify. And what I have found that in many cases, this is absolutely not true. So think about this. Get a pencil and piece of paper. And if you have one, or go get one, or pull up your computer and type this out. But if your veteran is over age 65, or what the Veterans Administration calls unemployable, and if they served at least one day during the dates of wartime, and if you want that list of dates of wartime, you can email me if you want to, or call me. I'll give you my email address first. It's real easy to remember. It's Randall Baxter, RANDALLBAXTER, at randallbaxter.com. Just say, hey, I need a list of the dates of service for aid in attendance for my father or grandfather, whatever. We're getting a lot of folks right now for the Korean War. We still have some for World War II, but most of the people that we're dealing with right now are Korean War. I'll send you those dates of service. Or you can call my office at 865-525-2323 and have one of my staff members. I probably won't answer the phone. I'd stay so busy. But have one of my staff members get your name and address and send you by email or by mail the list of the qualifications for dates of service. Remember, you have to have 90 days of service, at least one of those days being during wartime. You did not have to be on the battlefield. You could have been peeling potatoes in Kansas. You still qualify. By date of service. So call 865-525-2323 and get the qualification papers. We also, if you want it, we have what's called a part one and part two. It's the information and questions that you'll need to answer before you present yourself to the Veterans Administration. A lot of people get declined by the Veterans Administration because they do not present themselves correctly on the first attempt. My staff and I will help you do that for free. There's no charge to get that done. We'll give you an analysis. You know, you know, the best thing that might happen is we might be able to say, hey, you don't need us. But, you know, a married veteran couple can get, can qualify if they have the right, if the right cost of care. Over $2,000 a month. So if you're out there struggling, and I run into so many veterans who are going without care, going without help with toileting and with dressing and grooming and oral care and transferring and walking and companionship, and somebody take them to the doctor because they don't think they have the money to buy those benefits. And we can show you exactly what the income formula is and what the asset formulas are in order to qualify for that benefit before you present yourself or before you get declined. And you know what? It's absolutely free. But, you know, I don't know everybody in town. I know a lot of people. I might not know you. I might not know your parents. But if you would like that information, give me a call, 525-2323. Ask for the Veterans Aid and Attendance Package. We'll mail it to you for free or email it to you. Most of the time, it's the children of those veterans that need more information. And, you know, and a lot of things that a lot of folks don't know is the children can charge the veteran for the service and be reimbursed by the Veterans Administration. The money comes tax-free to the veteran. Only thing you have to do if you're providing care for your mother or your father or grandfather is you have to pay income tax on that money. But it's a benefit that your parents or your grandparents were given because they earned it because they served our country during wartime. So don't go without care. Don't go without benefits. Don't work all day at your job and then have to go in at night and provide a free service when you can pay for respite care or you can pay yourself for care or a family member for care to take care of our elderly veterans. So anyway, the information is free. The service is free. The application, if you want to apply, is free. We'll help you get organized to see how it works, and you'll not see a bill from us. But anyway, that's just something that you might need to be aware of. So I told you I was going to tell you a story about Lieutenant Alexander Bonneman, Marine Corps League Detachment Number 924 of Knoxville, Tennessee. It was the club I went to speak to when I learned about Mr. Bonneman. I told you about the video I was watching where the archaeologist was brushing off the area and had found the skull and had actually found the body recently of Lieutenant Alexander Bonneman, and they are returning his remains to East Tennessee. He has a stone already in memoriam, but we're bringing this soldier home, and there's going to be a ceremony for him in September. I think it's September 27th or somewhere in there. I'll get the exact date for you. If anybody's out there listening and knows more about that, I'd like to hear about it from you. But anyway, right after we go to this next break, I'm going to tell you the story of Lieutenant Alexander Bonneman. I've told you parts of it before, but this is a real live American hero that probably didn't even need to be there, but he was there because he volunteered and he wanted to serve his country, and it cost him his life, or he gave his life. It didn't cost him. He gave his life for his country. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. You're listening to The Veteran Next Door Live. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
back to the Veteran Next Door live. Call 865-243-8255. That's 243-TALK. And now your host, Randall Baxter.
Welcome back to the Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we've been talking about benefits for elderly veterans, and some of the bridges have been named, and we're going to talk about one last bridge here, but first you need to know the story. And I pulled this off the internet. This is an article written by Michael Miller. But there's a grandson of Mr. Bonnieman named Clay Bonnieman Evans. And he traveled 5,000 miles from home and deep in a pit on the Pacific island of Basio when he heard the words his family had waited for so long. Now, Basio was an island in the Tarawa archipelago. Basio was one of the key islands there at Tarawa that had to be taken. It was a vicious fight. The tides weren't right, and a lot of the Marines were trapped out on a reef and couldn't get off it. When they finally made it to the island, they were trapped behind a wall with machine gun fire everywhere, and they couldn't get over the wall without getting gunned down. And Clay Bonnieman Evans was listening to that lady who was brushing that skull with the paintbrush when she said, "Hey, it's gold." That was Christian Baker, and with a brush, the archaeologist gently swept the sand off an unmistakable shape, a human skeleton with a mouth full of gilded fillings. "It's gold," she said. Two words to end a 71-year wait. Two words to solve a mystery that had vexed Evans' family for four generations. Two words to give a long-lost war hero the happy ending he deserved. First Lieutenant Sandy Bonnieman, Jr. was finally coming home. For the better part of a century, 70 years worth, the Medal of Honor recipient was literally lost to the chaos and carnage of World War II. His grave said buried at sea, but even I knew that was not true. His family knew better. Sandy Bonnieman was entombed somewhere on the island of Basio, in the Tarawa archipelago, entombed after a battle that he fought so bravely in and was awarded the Medal of Honor. One of the stories is how his grandfather, 53-year-old freelance journalist from Colorado, tracked his grandfather's remains. And that's almost as incredible as Bonnieman's story. It involves gunfights, flamethrowers, radar and drones, mass graves, and even a cadaver dog named Buster. And Mr. Evans told the Washington Post, "It's incredible, just incredible." But you know, this story begins on December 7, 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Sandy Bonnieman was a miner near Santa Fe, New Mexico. He had already served a stint in the Army and was now 31 years old, so he wasn't a young man. But when he heard the news, he re-enlisted, this time as a Marine. By the time he landed in Tarawa Atoll, a string of strategically important islands in the middle of the Pacific, Bonnieman was the executive officer of the 2nd Battalion, 8th Marine Shore Party. Shore Party sounds kind of ominous, doesn't it? Especially when your shore party was going ashore the island of Basio on the Tarawa Archipelago. So about 2 years after December 7, 1941, it's actually November 1943, the Marines tried to take Basio from the Japanese. Bonnieman led his party across the island, destroying enemy outposts as he went. On the second day of the epic struggle for that strategically important piece of coral, First Lieutenant Bonnieman determined to effect an opening in the enemy's strongly defended defense line, led his demolitions teams in an assault on the entrance of a huge bomb-proof shelter which contained approximately 150 Japanese soldiers. This strong point was inflicting heavy casualties upon Marines and was holding up the advance. Remember how we talked about in World War I, Buck Karnes said, "Well, I about had enough of this." Remember how the Over Mountain men in the Revolutionary War said, "Hey, we about had enough of this." But after a day of attacking the shelter, Bonnieman led a full-on assault. Using flamethrowers and explosives, he and his men forced the Japanese into the open. Most of the enemy were shot as they left the shelter, but several attacked Bonnieman. Assailed by additional Japanese, he stood at the forward edge of the position and killed three of the attackers before he fell mortally wounded. His men beat off the counterattack and broke the back of the resistance. The island was declared secured on the day of First Lieutenant Bonnieman's death. His family back in Knoxville, Tennessee, received news of his death a few weeks later. Bonnieman's wife and 12-year-old daughter, Frances, traveled to Washington to receive his Medal of Honor. But if the story of Bonnieman's heroics was well recorded, the location of his body was not. As the Marines moved to secure the island and press on through the Pacific, they hurriedly buried their men in mass graves. And so started a mystery that would stretch out for 71 years. Bonnieman's parents desperately tried to discover where their son had been buried. They got all these stories that he was buried here or there. Evans told the Washington Post in a phone interview from his home in Colorado, until finally my great-grandfather gave up and bought a headstone that said, buried at sea. Can you imagine how news like that would just shatter a family? Hey, your son has the Medal of Honor, and we don't know where he's buried. I had heard a different story. I had heard that once the bunker was knocked out, the U.S. Navy, in order to secure the position, bombarded the whole battle area just to be sure everything was cleared out. I guess that wasn't true. Evans grew up believing that his grandfather was buried in an anonymous grave at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, a lush circular cemetery in Honolulu nicknamed the Punch Bowl. I guess you have to have closure. You have to figure out, you know, you have to close this out and have some peace about where your loved one is. But in 2009, he learned that the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command was planning to return to Tarawa to try to identify the remains of American Marines. Folks, in Hawaii, Honolulu, Hawaii, we have a group of Americans funded by the United States government that continues a search for World War II, Vietnam, and Korean War veterans. Some we know where they are, with this, North Korea won't let us go get them. But when Evans looked into the project, he learned that it was really being pushed along by a small Florida-based nonprofit called History Flight. Evans reached out to organization's founder, Mark Noah, who agreed to help. In August 2010, Mr. Evans flew the 5,726 miles from Colorado to the archipelago in the middle of the Pacific Ocean to search for his family member. He said, I reached a conclusion that I was going to hitch my cart to this little bitty nonprofit because I could see the dedication and the determination there. He said, I honestly never saw that with JPAC. So he said, hey, Mark, I want to work with you. Over the next 5 years, Evans would go back four more times to the now overcrowded island. Basio, if you look at a map, it's barely a mile long. But about 20,000 people live there. That's a bunch of people. He says, I've done all kinds of volunteer stuff for them. I have dug holes. I have sifted sand. I have cleaned bones. I have done PR work. I have called families looking for DNA samples. And I have done anything that they have wanted me to do. And I've been happy to do it because they've gotten results. Results meaning body identification. Lots of them. But never Sandy Bonnieman. Never Medal of Honor winner Sandy Bonnieman. Finally, in late March of this year, Noah called Mr. Evans and said he thought his team was close to finding his grandfather. Can you imagine the chills that, you know, if your grandfather was a war hero and you had never found his body and somebody calls and says, we think we found your grandfather. Using ground-penetrating radar, old military maps, the latest GPS technology, remote-controlled drones, and Buster the dog, they found a trench dubbed Cemetery 27. And it was thought that Bonnieman was in that trench. Evans flew to Taro once more, but a lot of work remained. "It's like finding a needle in a haystack," he said. In archaeology, 6 inches is as good as 1,000,000 miles, because if you miss what you're looking for, then you missed it. Could you imagine looking for him and stopping digging 6 inches before you found him? So for 2 weeks, Evans, Baker, Noah, and others dug for bodies. They found more than 12 Marines. And each time they would check the teeth for Bonnieman's distinctive gold fillings. The benefit of being a bit older and a touch wealthier than his fellow Marines. And again, you know, I told you the story about the USS Indianapolis. Earl Henry, the dentist, spent most of his time fixing the teeth of the sailors on the ship, the USS Indianapolis, because most of the sailors had been from the Depression era and did not have good dental care while they were at home. But Alexander Bonnieman didn't suffer that. He had the luxury of being from a family that could afford to have dental work and could afford to replace bad teeth with gold fillings and gold bridges. Plus, it was easier to tell that soldiers, forensic experts could tell a body, even though it had been buried for 6 or 7 years, whether it was that of a 17 to 19-year-old man-boy or a 31-year-old man. But finally, on May 28th of this year, Baker was inspecting body number 16 when she spotted another skeleton barely a foot away. She carefully scraped away the sand from all around the skull, and then she began to brush clean the century-old teeth. Remember now, he was, he's a century old now. That's when she saw the gold. Can you imagine the chill if she knew she was looking for one of the few soldiers in that grave that had gold teeth, and she brushed it away and saw that there was a mouthful of gold teeth in the skull? Evans was there. That was his grandfather, buried in that sand, buried in that trench, cemetery number 27, lined up probably hours after his death and put in a ditch and covered up with probably a steamroller or something. He said, "I definitely had tears in my eyes thinking about my great-grandparents who lost their son and my mom and my aunt who lost their father." The mystery was over, but the story wasn't complete. We're going to complete that story here in just a minute, but we've got to look at the weather. It's raining outside here. You're listening to The Veteran Next Door Live. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
back to The Veteran Next Door live. Call 865-243-8255. That's 243-TALK. And now your host, Randall Baxter.
So, we're talking about bridges here on The Veteran Next Door and the names of some of those bridges. And I've been telling you a story about Lieutenant Alexander Bonnieman and how his family member, his grandson, went and found his body on Batio. But, you know, let's, you know, go get on the interstate, drive up to Pellissippi. You can turn right and go to Oak Ridge. You turn left and go to Maryville. If you turn left and go to Maryville, it won't be long before you cross the Lieutenant Bonnieman Bridge. And if you get a chance, like I said earlier, with your kids or your grandbabies, tell them the story of Lieutenant Bonnieman. The late Marine was First Lieutenant Alexander Bonnieman of Knoxville, Tennessee, who gallantly gave his life in battle for Batio Island, Tarawa Atoll, Gilbert Islands, on the 22nd of November, 1943. And he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest military award for his heroism. You know, that medal was given to his teenage daughter, Miss Frances Bonnieman, by James F. Forrestal, then Secretary of Navy. You know that name Forrestal? That was when, I think it was John McCain crashed an airplane on the Forrestal. But Sandy Bonnieman was born in Atlanta, Georgia, on May 2nd, 1910, so he'd be 105 years old now. But when only 2 years old, his family moved to Knoxville. Alexander Bonnieman Sr., father of the deceased, was president of the Blue Diamond Coal Company of Knoxville, Tennessee. As a youth, a Marine officer attended Daxton School of Knoxville and graduated from the Newman School in Lakewood, New Jersey before entering Princeton University. So this is a smart dude. The Tennessean enlisted in the Army Air Corps as a flying cadet on 28th of June, 1932, and was sent to the pre-flight school of Randolph Field, Texas, and he was honorably discharged the 19th of September, 1932. So he thought his military career was done. Following his discharge, he went to work with his father, whose firm was one of the largest coal mining companies in the United States. And on February 15, 1933, he was married to Josephine Bell of San Antonio, Texas. And it was in 1938 that Alexander Jr. acquired his own copper mine in the mountains about 60 miles from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And folks, a lot of the miners were exempt from the draft. Didn't have to go back to war, but when the war broke out, he decided to join the Marines in July 1942. He enlisted as a private in Phoenix, Arizona. And subsequently, he received his recruit training at the Marine Corps base, San Diego, California. In October that year, Private Bonnieman sailed for the South Pacific aboard the USS Mansonia with the 6th Marine, 2nd Marine Division. Combat in the final stages of the Guadalcanal campaign followed for the 6th Marines, and the Tennessean had his first encounter with the Japanese. And in February 1943, the Marine, now corporal, received a field promotion to the rank of 2nd Lieutenant. The next step was Tarawa. So obviously people got to see that, you know, he was older than most of the other men. He was smarter, or seemed to be smarter. Maybe he just came from a wealthier background, and people saw that and thought he'd make a good officer. But he landed on D-Day, November 20th, First Lieutenant Bonnieman. He was promoted on September 1, 1943, and was executive officer of the 2nd Battalion, 8th Marine Shore Party, when the assault troops were pinned down by heavy enemy artillery fire at the seaward end of the Long Batio Pier. If you look at a map, there's a big old long pier. The water was so shallow there that they had to have this big long pier so the ships could pull up, and they would unload the ships on the pier and bring them into the island. Lieutenant Bonnieman, on his own initiative, organized and led the men over the open pier to the beach. Now, as he went to that beach, there was a wall when he came onto the beach, and a lot of Marines were trapped behind that wall. And they were trapped by a bunker, which you heard a few minutes ago, that had 150 Japanese soldiers in it. And then he voluntarily obtained flamethrowers and demolitions, organized his pioneer shore party into assault demolitionists, and directed the blowing up of several hostile installations before the first day of the battle. On the second day of the epic struggle, then they had to go back and get resupplied. On the second day of the epic struggle for that strategically important piece of coral, Lieutenant Bonnieman determined to effect an opening in the enemy's strongly defended defense line. led his demolitions team in an assault on the entrance to a huge bomb-proof shelter, which contained approximately 150 Japanese soldiers. And when we say bomb-proof, that means that the airplanes couldn't knock it out and the Navy guns offshore couldn't knock it out. The Japanese had had time to build it very, very strong. And that strong point was inflicting heavy casualties upon the Marines and was holding up their advance. The enemy position was about 40 yards forward of the Marine lines. Lieutenant Bonneman advanced his team to the mouth of the position, killing many of the defenders before they were forced to withdraw to replenish their supply of ammunition and grenades. On the third and final day of the Tarawa battle, the Knoxville miner renewed his attack upon the enemy position, leading his men in the placing of flamethrowers and demolitions in both mouths of the cave. They were close. Realizing that the seizure of this formidable bastion was imperative to make the Marine attack successful, Lieutenant Bonneman pressed his attack and gained the top of the structure, flushing more than 100 of its occupants into the open, where they were shot down. Assailed by additional Japanese, the lieutenant stood at the forward edge of the position and killed three of the attackers before he fell mortally wounded. His men beat off the counterattack and broke the back of the resistance. The island was declared secured on the day of Lieutenant Bonneman's death. I bet you didn't know that when you crossed that bridge. And think about that. And then, and ever since I learned that story, when I went to that Marine Club 3 or 4 years ago and learned about Lieutenant Bonneman and who he was, I didn't know the whole story, and it's just ironic that now, a couple years later, his body had been found in cemetery number 27. So after the battle, in order to stop disease from dead bodies and to clean up the island and get it ready to launch airplanes and to be a shipping station for the next advance on the next islands, they had to bury the soldiers as quick as they could. So they dug a big trench, and they lined up I guess they separated the American soldiers from the Japanese soldiers. Put the American soldiers in that trench and covered that trench up. From what I'm picking up, they didn't list the names of the soldiers they put in that trench. It's just if you were dead, they put you in that trench. But they didn't keep a list of where they were or who they were or what they had done, but the other Marines had told the story of Mr. Bonneman, Lieutenant Bonneman, and it wasn't long before he was awarded the Medal of Honor. But it took 71 years, led by his own family, not by the U.S. government. The U.S. government was willing to let it just be over with. And it took a nonprofit, independent of the United States government, to go out and find that, to help him find that cemetery number 27. And again, they knew it was Lieutenant Bonneman when the archaeologist with the paintbrush started brushing, working on one body that she had already found another body right next to it. I saw the picture. It looks to me like they were lined up next to each other. Somebody had gone in and lined up all the American soldiers in a row, and then looks like they had just bulldozed sand over them and marked it cemetery number 27. So, you know, cemetery number 27 tells me there were lots of cemeteries there and lots of American soldiers buried there. And I guess they'll stay there forever, maybe unidentified. But anyway, brutal battle, led by heroism, named a bridge. Everybody forgot what was going on. And I'd say thousands of cars cross that bridge every day, not knowing the story of Lieutenant Bonneman. Maybe they've heard rumors that they know, you know, I guess by the fact that they see the name Lieutenant on the front of it, they figure he's military and he probably did something heroic. They don't know what he did or why he did it or who he was, how old he was, that he had a wife and children. Why don't you tell them that story when you cross that bridge? Kids will want to know it. We'll come back in a few minutes to wrap the show up. You're listening to The Veteran Next Door live. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
Back to the Veteran Next Door live. Call 865-243-8255. That's 243-TALK. And now your host, Randall Baxter.
Welcome back to the Veteran Next Door live. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion today of the bridges. Not all the bridges, but some of the bridges in Knoxville, and as they're named after veterans, all who have received the Medal of Honor. So, and I just want to tell you, you know, the children in the back seat of your car, parents and grandparents, they need to know those stories. And if you want to carry on a conversation with the kids when you're traveling, tell them a story about the bridge you just crossed. Tell them why it's named what it's named. So, next week is the first weekend of year number 6 of the Veteran Next Door. We're going to spend the show next week talking about some of the guests that we've had on the show, some of the stories that we've had, some of the experiences that we've had, some of the growth that we've had as far as veteran communities and veteran organizations starting to participate in the show. So we'll be hitting that real hard. But there's another little story I want to tell you. You know, we're talking about memorials here in Knoxville. There is another memorial that some of you may know about, some of you don't know about. But for many years, the only memorial to a sinking ship was the troop-carrying riverboat Sultana that sunk on the Mississippi River on April 27, 1865. And although several people died in that catastrophe, it didn't really hit the news too much because it had just been 2 weeks since the Civil War had been declared over. And it had just been a little less than 2 weeks since the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, had been assassinated. So, you know, on April 27, 1865, the USS Sultana, I don't know if it's called USS, called the Sultana, it's a Mississippi River side-wheel steamboat, big old huge steamboat. And on April 27, 1865, that boat exploded. And it was the greatest maritime disaster in the United States history. They were estimated 1,800 of her 2,427 passengers died when three of the boat's four boilers exploded and she burned to the waterline and sank near Memphis, Tennessee. This disaster has long been overshadowed in the press by other contemporary events. John Wilkes Booth, President Lincoln's assassin, was killed the day before. So sometimes back then, news got to be so busy that you might miss the deaths of 1,800 soldiers. But the wooden steamboat was constructed in 1863, and it was being used or contracted to bring prisoners of war home. You know, and there's a monument to the Sultana in South Knoxville. But it's there in South Knoxville because hundreds of the men who died on that boat and dozens who survived were on their way to the Knoxville, Tennessee area. By most accounts, and I'm taking this from the cover story in the Knoxville Mercury. It was given to me as a gift. Somebody said, you really need to talk about this story. But by most accounts, almost a quarter of the passengers on the Sultana and about a quarter of the dead were members of the 3rd Tennessee Cavalry. And most of those were from East Tennessee. So Jack Neely wrote a story about the Sultana. And again, there's a picture in the newspaper. But you know, if those 1,800 deaths had happened in any other month other than April 1865, it would be the legendary American disaster every school kid knew about. It would be the subject of folk songs and novels and movies, and that was the opening paragraph of Mr. Neely. But, you know, it was a month of Confederate surrender, ending our bloodiest war, the month of America's first and most critical presidential assassination. The month of April 1865, they say, deadened editors and readers to the horrible news of the riverboat Sultana. How can you talk about the death of common soldiers when we just lost a president and just captured his assassin, and General Grant, General Lee had met at Appomattox? the most common explanation for why most Americans never heard of the worst maritime disaster in American history in Body Camp. It was deadly. It was more deadly than the Titanic. In fact, it was deadlier than any shipwreck in the world in the 19th century. Of course, it was maybe a matter of perspective. You know, in fact, it was, you know, perhaps it was a matter of perspective. Its losses didn't compare to that of the Civil War's dozen deadliest battles. Although the Sultana disaster had a death toll less than half than that of September 11, 2001, it came across as a short page four story in the New York Times. 1,800 soldiers, majority from the Knoxville, many from the Knoxville, Tennessee, East Tennessee area, died on that ship that day. Of course, another problem for publicity compared to the Titanic is that the Sultana's passengers didn't include the rich and the famous. Most of its passengers were recently paroled prisoners of war. Union men who had spent the last several months in Confederate prison camps and were finally on their way home from a war that was blessedly over. Can you imagine that? The war's over. You survived it. You're in the cavalry. You're in cavalry battles. Your group gets captured when they could have been killed. They're sent to a prisoner of war camp. The war is over. The president gets assassinated. They capture John Wilkes Booth. You're going home, and the boat you're on is overloaded. I guess that's what made the boilers catch on fire and explode. But, you know, maybe the Sultana's problem is that it's too strange to be legendary, that it should happen not on high seas, but on a river within view of both shores. It might be hard to dramatize that. Whatever remains of the Sultana is believed to be under layers of silt near the Mississippi River, more than 400 miles from Knoxville. For many years, the only memorial to the Sultana was in the cemetery on Maryville Pike. Even today, it's reputedly the most impressive one. It's there because hundreds of the men who died on that boat and dozens who survived were on their way to Knoxville, Tennessee. By most accounts, almost a quarter of the passengers of the Sultana and about a quarter of the dead were members of the 3rd Tennessee Cavalry, and most of those were from East Tennessee. Of the survivors of that disaster, almost 50 were from one tight population center composed of Blount, Sevier, and Knox counties. The town that soldiers on the deck of the Sultana were picturing as home was unlike any other. Much more divided than most, Knoxville was neither Union or Confederate and didn't think of it itself as North or South. In fact, whether this compact community of 6,000 was a city or not might have been a matter of debate in its oyster saloons. Think about that. Now, we've covered the Battle of Knoxville in this show. We've talked about it, about how in 1863, it's in the New York Times, the Southern troops were pulled out to go down and fight the Battle of Chattanooga, and the Northern troops moved in immediately. And there were just about as many people happy to see the Confederates go as they were happy to see the Union troops come. If you read Mr. Seymour's book, for those of you who live in Seymour, there's a guy who wrote a book about the divided loyalties, and he called East Tennessee the breadbasket of the South, where all the green beans and tomatoes and things were grown. The rest of the South's growing cotton and indigo and rice, but the vegetables that were feeding both armies was coming right out of East Tennessee. So when these soldiers came home, they were Union soldiers that had been captured that were from Knoxville, Tennessee. We had a large portion of these Tennesseans and from Knoxville that were supplying troops to the Union cause. And those soldiers who were captured came home, and they came home. All they had to do was come up the Mississippi River, turn right on the Ohio, turn right again on the Tennessee, go through Nashville, go down to Muscle Shoals if they could get through, and come right up through Chattanooga, and they'd be in Knoxville. They were going home. And three of the four boilers on that ship exploded and caught that thing on fire. And they could see the shore to the left, the west shore of the Mississippi. They could see the shore to the right, the east shore of the Mississippi. And that ship burned so fast that they couldn't get off the ship, and they burned alive and they drowned. But, you know, Knoxville was almost, it was 400 miles from Knoxville, but if you went by river, it was almost 1,000 river miles upstream from the Sultana explosion. But it came as a center for remembering it. And from a distance or on a map, Knoxville, roughly midway between the Confederate headquarters at Richmond and Jackson, Mississippi, could look like the Old South. But then if you looked at it again, it would look like the North because it was an industrial city. So anyway, I could go on and on and on about the Sultana, and I will in a different show for you guys that want to know the whole story. But first of all, I want to thank you all for allowing me into your homes for every weekend over the past 5 years. We've done over 468 hours of programming, published one book, got two more on the way. We hope you'll enjoy those. I hope you'll buy our book, and I appreciate you listening to Veteran Next Door. All I got to say is we're looking forward to another rip-roaring year. We expect to do a lot of things. We're not running out of World War II veterans, but I'd like to hear from all of them. But folks, once again, thank you. You've been listening to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll see you next week.
Been listening to The Veteran Next Door live with Randall Baxter. If you enjoyed today's show, then visit theveterannextdoor.com. That's theveterannextdoor.com. Be sure to join us next week at the same time for The Veteran Next Door live on Knox Talk Radio 94.3 FM WNFZ.